Hey, this is Kari Payton. I play King Ezekiel on The Walking Dead, and you're listening to The Walking Dead Underground Podcast. It's gonna be awesome.
You're listening to The Walking Dead Underground. Now your hosts, Cynic, Igri, and Ryan.
So here we are live at the Georgia World Conference Center in Atlanta at Walker Stalker 2017. Cynic and Ig, live from the location. All right, Cynic, what do you think so far? How's Walker Stalker been treating you?
Well, first off, I'm just completely surprised at the enormous size of this place. I mean, you could literally fit most of the town that we're from in this area. I mean, the building's beautiful. So far, it's been pretty interesting as far as the way it's been handled. I think the way they do the lines is very proficient. We're having a good time.
I agree. We have been having a good time. Lots of stuff to see here. Just about everybody you'd want to see from The Walking Dead is here. A couple exceptions, pretty minor ones, though. But everybody that I've interacted with, at least personally so far, has been just an absolute joy to be around. Stephen Ogg was so much fun to be around, and so was Cooper Andrews. Cooper Andrews was hilarious, and he made cobbler for everybody. And they were serving it at his booth. It was so neat. How about you? Who'd you like to interact with?
Well, Cooper was great. I mean, I saw on Instagram that he basically stayed up the whole night before making cobbler for the fans. It just trays and trays and trays of it. He had music at his booth. He was fun. He was interactive. I mean, we got to talk to him about Muse. We got to talk to him about The Walking Dead a little bit. Just a bang-up guy. I just met Domingo Coleman a little while ago. The guy is absolutely fan-friendly. I mean, there's so many people that we ran into here, and some of them were nice enough to do IDs for us. I mean, I couldn't ask for nicer interactions. We just got done with a photo op with Andrew Lincoln. Very personable, very nice, very, you know, the soft-spoken guy. All in all, I mean, I haven't met one person that I didn't absolutely adore.
And that's the thing, is they're so warm and so welcoming. It just makes you feel like this is a family. So when you see TWD family out there, it really does ring true when you're here at Walker Stalker. Not only that, but the fans. The fans here are amazing and friendly and warm. It's really been a good atmosphere all around. I mean, there's been a lot of cosplay, more Negans than you can shake a stick at. But it's really been kind of crazy going on here. A lot of good makeup jobs for walkers, too. What do you think? What'd you see?
I think you would want to go with a Lucille at. But, yeah, I mean, usually when you go to these things, the cosplay is okay. I mean, the cosplay here is on par with what we saw at New York City Comic Con just a few months ago. Negan's great, Daryl Dixon's, you know, there's an Abraham walking around that's pretty spot on, and they're all friendly. They'll all stop for pictures. There was Pennywise and a kid in a raincoat that stood out to me. I mean, and they allow these people to come in costume, and they don't hassle them, and they, you know, they check them through security. Security's actually been surprisingly lax, which I was surprised. You know, I figured we'd go through metal detectors and everything else, and that just really wasn't the case. But the people that work at the convention have been extremely helpful. I mean, the security has been extremely helpful. I haven't seen one problem, even though that they're selling alcohol. They've really put on a hell of an event here.
It has been amazing. My favorite cosplay, by the way, was a guy dressed as Shiva wearing a security guard's outfit. Said that he was a security for the sanctuary. It was pretty awesome. I liked it a lot. That being said, I mean, there's just so much going on here. A lot of good panels. Some really interesting merchandise, I mean, and some non-Walking Dead-themed merchandise, which, you know, anytime you go to something like this, there's going to be a variety of things that doesn't really apply, but that doesn't make it cool anyway. It really has been a lot of fun here. What else do you think? I mean, any other closing thoughts you have about the Walker Stalker convention?
Well, the convention in itself is interesting. I mean, as far as this is the biggest one I've ever been to, and it's the only one I've been to, which is also the 5th anniversary. What surprised me the most is not how well-run the convention is, because there has been hiccups. I think there was something wrong with JDM's photo op, which put his autographs, which there was a lot of people that were upset that their autographs were canceled, but they were also promptly refunded for it. The biggest surprise to me coming here was actually the city of Atlanta. I mean, it's really gone through quite a renaissance, and as far as big cities, and I've been to a couple over the last couple of years, their skyline is on par with Philly and most of the other major cities I've been to now. I mean, the restaurants are amazing, the hotels are, I mean, we stayed in an off-brand hotel like a mile from the event, and it was probably one of the best hotels I've ever stayed in. So the city of Atlanta is the thing that I'll take away from this most, but the way that the convention's been run is as good, if not better than anything that I've seen. How about you?
Oh, I agree completely. The ATL is going down here. I really do love it. This convention center is right next to the old Olympic Park, so real close to a lot of things that people have seen as far as what was going on back in 96 here. But from 96 till now, he's right. There's been a renaissance, and they've really reinvested in the city. I mean, it's a college town, but it's much more than that. I mean, Atlanta's a big place. I mean, we've also seen the new stadium that they put up here, the Mercedes-Benz Stadium for the Falcons. It's a beautiful piece of architecture. But they still have the classic architecture a lot of places here. So you see the older buildings, and the mix of the old and the new, I think, speaks a lot for Atlanta, because there's a lot of history here and a lot of we're moving places. We're moving into the future. I like it a lot. And if you ever get a chance, come to Atlanta. It's a beautiful, beautiful city.
This was your first convention. What are you taking away from this? What is the one thing that you're going to remember?
I'm going to remember a lot of standing in line, but a lot of payoff at the end of it. It was amazing. I mean, I did some photo ops with some people, and every time I got in there, and the photo op is really, really fast. You only get a few seconds, but you know what? These guys are so good at conveying warmth and gratitude in about a five-second period. I was so impressed with that. But even when you stand in line for signatures, they are really take the time to talk to you. And, I mean, they'll find the smallest thing. Stephen Ogg noticed that the Cynic Radio podcast logo I had on my hat was done like the Stranger Things logo. And he started talking to me about Stranger Things. And we had a good five-minute conversation about Stranger Things. It was really neat. He just found something and latched onto it and started having a talk and talked about how he knew the kids. I thought it was neat. I mean, there's a lot of things going on, and just that anybody will just stop and talk to you. I loved every second of it.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, Russ Marquardt was amazing. On top of Cooper, I mean, Russ was just an amazing meet. Energetic. I was watching him do videos for other people. And, you know, he couldn't have been nicer when I asked him to do an ID. And he claims he's actually even heard of the show, which surprised me. But also, the word's getting out that this is the place to be.
It is the place to be. We've got the best stuff coming for you. I mean, we got real analysis. We got some humor. And we love coming and bringing it to you every week. And this week, bringing it to you live from Atlanta.
I mean, I can't say enough about the way that things have been handled here. I mean, not only is the information readily available to everyone else, but Michonne Denai was running late. And the owner actually came over and was talking to the fans and apologizing. And a couple things that struck me very cool. We didn't see it personally, but all over the social media, Norman Reedus had bought pizza for his line when they were waiting while he was off doing photo ops. Josh McDermott did the same thing. I mean, you can tell that most of these actors really love their fans. I haven't run into any standoffish actors. I mean, if you have the ability, and the one caveat I would say, don't come here general mission. Just don't. Because, unless you're just coming for the event and to walk around, don't come general mission. I mean, if you can get a higher end ticket, like a VIP ticket or even a gold or platinum, which I know that they're hard to get, if you come general mission, don't expect to get too much done. Don't expect to get and anymore with the way that they've been pre-selling autographs. I don't know if you're going to get to see any of the main cast anymore. However, if you can come VIP or if you can come gold, I would definitely recommend coming to Atlanta. I would definitely recommend coming to any of the other Walker Stalkers, because I've been to Boston, I've been to New York, I've been to Philly, and this is, of course, the granddaddy. This is their Super Bowl. I mean, you don't get any bigger than this one. But at the same time, you've got to have those quick fingers on the internet to be able to wrangle yourself up an Andy photo op or signature, and any more Chandler and Jeffrey. And, you know, a few of the other ones they're pre-selling, and then you can't just walk up and buy a ticket. But the autograph system is great. The photo ops, I was actually surprised, because of all the events that I've been to, I've never done photo ops. And just to watch just the machine, which is the photo op system here, is just amazing. They have you in and your picture taken and your photo in your hand within 5 minutes. It's just completely insane.
It really is. But that being said, you know, when you're doing the general admission, you know, a lot of people are always focused at these shows on the high-end stars, the front-end people. You know, when you get down to the Jerrys and things like that, that's where the real meat and potatoes of these shows are. Those are the people you really got to spend time to meet, because they're hungry. They want to meet you. They want to know that they're liked or disliked or whatever. Come and talk to them. You'd be surprised how warm and inviting many of these people are. And even people that have died off on the show. Irony Singleton is here, and he's having a blast meeting fans. These stars are not just stars. They're people that care about what's going on. I think you would really enjoy it. And Cynic is right. If you really want to come and get the full experience, try and upgrade your ticket. But if all you can afford is a general admission, don't pass it up.
No.
Come on anyway. You're really going to like it. And go meet some of the lesser people. I mean, even Tobin Bell from the Saw series was here. Most of the people from Sons of Anarchy were here. And you could have gotten into them fairly easily, even with a general admission. So there are other things to do and other people to meet. And they're all very, very cool. Episode 2 opens with Rick and Daryl looking determined. King Ezekiel and Carol recovering from a blast laying on the ground, Jesus and Tara looking around, Morgan looking like he needs to clear, and Aaron going on a road trip. The Saviors are on maintenance duty, getting the munitions ready for whatever's next. Mara calls out to the lookouts on the radio, and after multiple attempts, only one answers. Just as she tells him to lock everything up, the caravan of carnage arrives. Aaron and his team of armored minivan-driving misfits open fire, and it's on. Cynic, does this seem like they sent the least capable people of hitting a target here? A lot of people are shooting, and very few are going down.
Yeah, I think they compared it somewhere along the lines to some stormtrooper shooting. Hilltop just does not have it when it comes to combat skills, but there was some Alexandrians mixed in there as well. I don't know. The strike force was heavily flawed, and what bothers me the most about this whole scene is that everybody in this show is an expert at shooting somebody in the head until it comes to shooting a live person, and then they lose all marksmanship skills. I love the battle. I love what they did with it. I don't think that the corrugated steel they were standing behind is going to stop any kind of bullets. Maybe, you know, make it so somebody can't really aim at them. But it really seemed like they had no battle plan other than we're just going to stand behind these cars.
It didn't seem very well thought out, well planned, and it's a little frustrating because, yes, it's like they're expert marksmen when it's convenient, but when it's not, you know, shooting like stormtroopers. I think that's a perfect analogy. It takes you out of it a little bit, you know, and I guess, you know, to an extent, since it's the primarily Hilltop people in that situation, and they're not kind of as combat ready as some of the others, okay, it kind of makes sense, but, you know, in that situation, it was just a little confusing, and I didn't love, love that opening.
I did love the fact that our buddy Ross Marquar was given something to do, and Aaron was leading that strike force. So I thought that was great that he was kind of really relegated to, like, nothing. You know, he was like a third or fourth tier character, and now they're kind of, you know, even though I understand it was a vehicle to put his boyfriend in jeopardy and for them to kind of play on our emotional strings a little bit, but I loved seeing him step up and take charge.
Yeah, that did work a little bit because he does have a presence. I mean, when he's on screen, when he's doing something, he can really chew up some scenery, which is fine. He's a great actor. I really enjoy the things that he does. I'd seen him before just kind of on YouTube and stuff because he was a comedian before. But he's doing a good job in this series, and I appreciate that they're giving him a bigger shot. Now we move over to the next group with Jesus, Morgan, and Tara back at the satellite station, where the Saviors have made a moat filled with walkers. The plan is mostly vague at this point. Don't let them shoot, and off they go. Morgan is offered help, to which he refuses, saying, "I don't die." Ryan, is this like ever? Maybe something more about Morgan we don't know?
I think Morgan's a video game character, and that's come out in this show, I think, complete with, like, I mean, I don't want to go too far into it, but complete with, like, seemingly having a health pack, you know, at ready to come back to life. And, Morgan's impressive in this episode. I think that, you know, one of the interesting things with this character, he's really one of the most well-developed characters in a lot of ways in the entire series, and you kind of see where he's like extremes. It's like almost like killing is a drug for him, and if he's gonna kill, he just takes it to another level, and you see why he's almost trying to rein in. Or he had been trying to rein in that whatever he had inside of him, because he has this kind of inside of him, where he's just, he can be just a murderer, maybe borderline serial killer. And I mean, it makes for, you know, some really impressive scenes with him. He's really one of the best characters to watch in action. But you really wonder, you know, what's this going to do to him in the long run, especially if he thinks he can't die. Like, if he thinks he's immortal, you know, this may be kind of foreshadowing of what's to come for him.
Well, it really is a gift and a curse, right? I mean, it's a gift if you want to live, but it's a curse when sometimes when Morgan is absolutely defeated and he's had enough and he doesn't want to live in this world and he can't seem to get himself killed proper. I mean, when you absolutely positively have to kill every motherfucker in the room, Morgan, there is no substitute.
The King and Carol seem shaken from the blast as walkers begin overtaking them. The damned are upon us, the King says, as everyone there shows they're fully capable of handling this situation. The guy that threw the grenade is on his way to go and get more savior help, and they need to catch up. Cynic, would this go faster if King Ezekiel didn't feel the need to go full Dungeon Master explanation every time they had to do anything?
You know, the proof is in the context, right? I mean, he's got to DM out or they're going to peter out and not want to fight. I had a lot of problems with this. You know, it takes all the kingdom to chase down one guy. I mean, I loved the way that the battle was done. I loved the walkers coming to spill out of the immediate care. You know, it was all very cool. Some very good lines, like Jerry yelling, you know, protect the king, and the king yelling, protect yourself. It was all very cool. And I love when Ezekiel swings the sword. I really do like show Ezekiel much better than comic book. I think he shows that he's a much more capable warrior and a much better leader, but I think that his confidence is eventually going to get the best of him. I think they may have won the day eventually, but I think this is going to end up costing them in the long run, and I think he's going to DM himself right into an ambush.
Ezekiel's character, I love the way he does motivate, and he's able to, you know, his confidence breeds confidence in others. No, I do agree that, you know, that, you know, in theory, at some point, I guess it depends. If he internally, you know, is more careful and understands the situation and is kind of more calculating internally, but externally he's projecting that confidence, then that's fine. That's one thing, and that's good, because that, you know, that's what a great leader does. Because, you know, even if he has his own reservations, they're moving forward. And so if he's able to project that air of confidence to everybody, that will make everybody else more confident. I think the question is does he internally feel as confident as he's kind of showing to everybody else? And I think that's where the potential problem is. But I do think that at this stage, like, he, you know, they bought into it. They're sold on Ezekiel, the D&D character, and I think he's taken it to another level this season so far, and I love it. You know, if there's plenty of things I've had issues with, but I love you know, as far as he needs to go with this. I'm motivated just watching him, and even when I think that the chips are down for them, you know, he can pull me back into it. So I'm liking it.
Yeah, well, it's hard not to succeed when you have a hype man like Jerry, right? I mean, because Jerry is just yelling out the praises of the king every chance he gets. Every time he says something, he's like, yeah, let's go kill some bitches. You know, I'll tell you the one person that isn't buying a bit of this, and that's Carol. I mean, she'll smile, she'll kind of, you know, she'll play like she's, you know, she's along for the ride, but deep down, I think she knows that this ends one way too. You know, that this guy is, you can only be that cocksure in this situation for that long, and bad things are going to happen to you. And I hate that, because the king is absolutely one of my favorite characters, and I worry for his safety if he continues to, you know, I think we, even not to jump too far in the episode, but I think they were even warned that something bad was coming, and he's like, we're going to press on. You know, no, maybe we should reevaluate the situation. This is the problem with the alliance. The coalition that Rick has is that we really don't have any battlefield tested generals. And, you know, other than Rick and Daryl, which they seem to lump up together, I mean, the Saviors seem like they've all fought these fights before and they all have a general idea. Like, right away, you know, when the episode started, they're like, all right, lock this down and go into formation. And, you know, they had a plan, even though they got blindsided, which they, you know, you would think if you got blindsided like this, a lot more people would die. That was the one thing that killed me. You know, listen, at the end of the season, they're going to need a whole host of new extras. But with the way they were shooting in this episode, maybe a lot of them are going to live through it. I mean, they're literally standing right in front of each other and can't hit one another. And some of them weren't even standing in full cover. So that drove me a little bit crazy. The tactics of the fight drove me a little bit crazy, but I did like the action through and through.
Yeah, speaking of all that, you know, back at Eren's ambush, seems like they don't need to kill everyone with firearms. They just need time. Ryan, what do you think of that strategy? Any chance that backfires?
I thought it was a smart strategy once you realize what they're kind of doing and what they're trying to accomplish by holding them there. It's just the question is, all of it seems like the entire plan, I mean, A, I don't understand all the entire plan. Like, a lot of this seems convoluted. I'm kind of confused as to who's where and what's going on and what the exact, the overall plan is. But it did make sense in a way, you know, if we can keep them in one place and let the dead come back, maybe, you know, that's a way to kind of smoke them out, I guess, so to speak. But, you know, all of this just relies on so many things going right that, you know, it's hard to imagine that, as we'll see, you know, it's hard to imagine that every detail goes right. And if every detail doesn't go right for them, it seems like they're going to screw themselves over at some point soon.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of those things that it's a thing said in the military that the battle plan never survives first contact, right? As soon as the shooting starts happening, the plan goes away and a new plan goes into effect and it's constantly evolving. And that's some of what I was seeing in the episode, is that things weren't always going 100% the way they needed them to go, and they kept trying to push on with the same plan rather than making any adjustments to, all right, this is happening, change the plan. And I think their lack of communication, because they don't have the radios that the Saviors have, so they can't communicate to the other people that are attacking different things, let them know what's happening.
That goes back to the, like I said, the lack of experience of someone like Eren or Jesus or Terra. You know, there's really a lack of experience in leadership there, where if things do go foobar, they don't know how to adjust. They don't know how to adapt. It's, you know, all right, we're going to do this and, you know, we're going to stick to this plan whether it works or not. And eventually we'll all run out of bullets because the cheat code will be up and then we're going to have to go fight hand to hand, or, you know, they'll get ate by some of their walkers. It's going to make it for a long season, that's for sure. I mean, even their victory last week was essentially just shooting out windows and knocking the fence over at Sanctuary. So it's definitely going to make for a long season, and eventually the Saviors are going to get their shit together and they're going to strike back. And when they do, you know, I hate to see what Alexander is going to look like. Or maybe I saw it already.
All right, at the front doors, two guards are asking about the shooting that they hear, and Mara tells them to stay there. These guys must not have been paying much attention, because right away, two headshots take them down. Rick, Daryl, and their team enter the front door looking for more guns. Meanwhile, at the satellite station of Doom, Morgan begins rattling the walker's cage. A couple of wandering sentries see him and shout, "Hey!" followed by quick arrows to the head. Now inside the station, Jesus, Terra, and Morgan, with their team, move through like they are a trained SEAL team, clearing the way, often only needing one shot to take out any Savior. Cynic, should they maybe have picked teams like Kickball to spread the ability around? Seems like everybody that can shoot is here instead of where the active shooting is happening.
Yeah, that's problematic. I mean, I understand that these smaller strike forces are a little more essential because, you know, they've got to be surgical in the way that they're doing things. Maybe we shouldn't have left Michonne and Carl at home. I mean, maybe they should be on the front lines as well, because they seem to be the only people that can shoot anybody.
I think it's just a problem with the writing, to be honest. There are a lot of situations where when the characters need to be effective, you know, like SEAL Team 6, they are. And when they need to be bumbling idiots, they're bumbling idiots. And when they need to be somewhere in between, they're somewhere in between. I think strategically, right, it makes sense to do it as they did. Like, you need it was set up where the two smaller teams. Kind of strike forces, they needed their best people because stealth and being quiet and efficiency were really important. Where, you know, the other situations, it's more about just holding them off and fighting. And yeah, kind of sucks that they're wasting ammo and nobody's dying, but you know, you don't need your best people in those situations where these are kind of life or death. You know, one wrong move can blow up the entire plan. So I think in this case, I actually think they made the right move. But I think it does become a problem in the show where, again, when they need to be perfect marksmen, they're perfect marksmen, and when it doesn't work for the plot, it doesn't work for the plot, and you know, there's just times where it just is going to take you out of it.
At the Shepherd Office Plaza, Rick and Daryl have finished searching the first floor, and they found Zip. So now they go upstairs. Cynic, is kicking a locked door the best way to gain entry?
It is when it's my heart, Ig. I mean, you know, when somebody walks up and just kicks the locked door to my heart, that says everything. It means they really want to gain entry. Listen, I don't know much about combat or ambush tactics. I do know that you want to be as quiet as possible. So maybe some lockpicking skills. Maybe they need to get Ezekiel's rogue in there and roll the 20-sided die and try to gain entry that way. But it is Rick effing Grimes, and Rick does whatever he wants, and he usually does it with a sense of style and flair.
All right, back at Aaron's ambush, the Saviors try flanking, and Aaron's beau Eric leads a charge to head them off. Fast switching is crazy in this episode, so now we go back to the satellite, and it's about to go down. A quick hand signal, all the doors are being busted in, and the team is taking care of business. As Morgan's door opens, one man is quickly shot, and then five come around some boxes and shoot Morgan and his two helpers. Ryan, is this it? Could this be it for Morgan? When you were watching at the time, did you have any idea whether or not Morgan was dead?
I had to rewind that because it happened so quick. I wasn't sure what had happened, and they couldn't kill Morgan. Did they just kill Morgan? And I had a feeling he wasn't dead. I feel like he's important enough that they would give him. They didn't linger long enough, and they didn't make it clear enough that he'd been, you know, mortally wounded or badly wounded even, for me to believe it. So I think once they cut, you know, I just thought, no, he deserves more, and his character would get more than a death like that. So, you know, I felt like, you know, at best, you know, he avoided it, and at worst, maybe TV science, like, he got shot in the arm and he'll be perfectly fine. You know, so I just figured, like, it was that was it. I didn't think anything more would. I just couldn't believe that he would go like that.
Oh, they're playing under Sons of Anarchy rules, right? I mean, you fall off a motorcycle going 60, and by next week you're fine. You know, no hospital stay, no concussion, no road rash. You're just fine.
Even your jacket's not ripped.
Listen, I'm gonna let you in on a little secret here. If Morgan dies, I riot. Because I've been Team Morgan since he's come back to the show. I mean, all the shot in the arm did was the graze of the arm. Because, listen, the other guys were clearly dead. I mean, our buddy Andy, you know, sorry, pal. I mean, you had some bright spots, and the other wide-eyed, I'm not able to shoot on at all when bad things happen guy, you know, he went out the door too. But I was more worried about Andy, which is an actor named Jeremy, a really good guy. They were clearly dead. They were clearly shot. There was no visible sign of injury on Morgan other than the fact that he was laying there with his eyes shut. So I wasn't buying that he was injured or even killed. I did think that this was going to elicit the reaction it did, which was the one-way ticket to Crazy Town. So, you know, every day Morgan, you know, he's just learned to kill again, has gone full clear Morgan, like when Rick found him back in their hometown. I knew it was going to be on, and that's exactly what happened. The only problem with that whole thing is he stopped one Savior short.
So Rick and Daryl decide stairs are hard, and decide to climb an elevator shaft instead. Now on the top floor, they decide to split up to cover ground faster. Back to the satellite again, Jesus and Tara find a Savior in the closet in a fresh pair of pee pants, begging not to get shot. As Jesus talks Tara into not killing him immediately, turns out it was a big ruse and he takes Jesus hostage. Ryan, are the showrunners making Tara so just intensely hard this season because of all the hate on her previously?
Yeah, it kind of feels like that a little bit. I don't mind it, but, like, develop that. You know, it's got to happen over time. It's hard, you know, really tough. Like, I think this is, you know, one of the great things about this show is that we do see characters grow and develop in the face of this, you know, extreme adversity. And, you know, it's a situation where you have to, otherwise it's life or death. And so her change is believable, But for it to happen so quickly is a little bit harder to take. You know, it just, things don't work like that. And so it's a little frustrating sometimes that it happens so fast. And so because of that, you know, it does feel like a bit of a reaction. And just one thing, quickly to go back to Rick and Daryl, it's the worst TV movie trope is, you know, two people and they decide to split up for no reason but to be but in this case they kind of said, you know, oh well, it'll be a little bit faster, and it's like, come on, you're by yourselves, don't split up. What's the point? Nothing can go right with that. And as soon as that happened, it's like, all right, well, they're both fucked. And sure enough, you know, didn't end well for Rick. So it's just like, that pissed me off. But yeah, getting back to Tara, yeah, I think a little too quick for her, for that change.
Alana seems like a great person. I was watching her when I was at Walker Stalker, and I was watching her interact with fans. She's down to earth. She's a good person. And I don't think she should have received any of the hate, especially the body shaming. But I don't think she should have received any of the hate she was getting, because this wasn't her fault. These were all bad writing and character decisions. So, all right, we're going to make Tara a badass, and we're going to put her in direct conflict with Jesus, who doesn't want to kill people, but she does. And so obviously, you know, the audience's propensity for bloodlust, they're going to agree with her. You know, they're going to be like, yeah, kill all these saviors. Listen, I agreed with her. You know, even after Jesus gets taken hostage, which I think would be a great next song for Carrie Underwood, instead of Jesus takes the wheel, Jesus takes the bait, because he completely fell for it. And the best line of the show was absolutely is, do you know how hard it is to piss your pants on command? It's like your dick knows you have pants on. I love that line. It was perfect. So Jesus takes the bait. You know, he does some ninja stuff to get out of it. And then once he's proven completely wrong, he's still, you know, he still won't do away with this guy. He still won't kill this guy. Maybe this isn't the guy to be leading your strike team. I mean, Paul's capable of some amazing things, but if he's not capable of pulling the trigger, he's going to put the rest of the team in jeopardy. And I didn't quite understand this. We're going to have a full conversation on morality while people are being shot around you. You know, you need to do away with this guy and get on to the next guy if the mission's going to succeed. And, you know, they just kind of sat around. Well, maybe we should. Maybe we should. Maybe we shouldn't. You know, maybe this guy smells a whole lot like piss. It didn't really matter. I mean, you know, kill the guy and move on to the next one. I can't personally myself say, oh, well, I'm going to turn the other cheek if this guy is going to turn around and shoot me the second that he gets free. You can't let that guy live.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. And the other side is I think the showrunners are trying a little too hard, because when you include Denise in the same breath as Abraham and Glenn, just to make it seem like she has some reason to feel about this, it just... that's pushing Tara too hard, too fast on the public. And I think they may get some lashback on that, just based on how do they want to treat Denise the same as they treat Glenn. I mean, you can't. So they hear radio calls for the saviors to GTFO, and we see Morgan and his friends laying on the ground. Morgan gets up, takes another gun, and starts clearing his way through the rest of the station. Now we're back to Aaron and his crew, and it seems like it was more suppressive fire to keep the saviors there as an ex-savior, as ex-savior walkers start to rise, becoming a bigger hazard for the saviors. Now we're over to King Ezekiel and Carol in the woods, and the axe man Jerry kills a walker. Cynic, is anyone a better giant axe wielder than Jerry? Maybe Paul Bunyan?
You know, he's only carried that now for the better part of a season and a half. It's about goddamn time Jerry swings that axe. I've been waiting for it, and the payoff was great. I mean, he split that guy open like a cantaloupe. I was really happy and really impressed with it. I mean, Cooper is a big dude, and, you know, they gave him the perfect weapon. You know, that axe could definitely do some damage, and we finally got to see it come into play. And, I wouldn't mind seeing him chase a couple saviors down with it either.
No, I think Jerry's awesome, and it's fun to see him in action. His loyalty, the humor, he's kind of the perfect companion for King Ezekiel, and brings a certain amount of, I don't know, just something. He's kind of magnetic. I don't know, just something about Jerry. It's just you're just fun to watch him. You know, I'd watch like a side show about Jerry. You know, Jerry and, well, I'd watch Jerry and Ezekiel, but I'd watch his own little like spinoff show, because he's just so fun to have there, and it's great to see him in action, and he definitely knows how to wield the axe.
So AMC, when you're listening, you need to roll out Fear the Walking Jerry.
Yeah,
put
exactly.
This out. So now we're back with King Ezekiel, and his motivation speaking tour is back at it with Carol. When asked what's about to happen, the king says, "And yet I smile." I love these lines when he does this. He says, "Do I feel the supreme confidence, or is it my lot, my job, to simply project such certainty? no and yes, yes and no, and then finally yes to both. Fake it till you make it, baby. Ryan, is that all that that he needs is a positive attitude to go out and actually win?
I don't know that it's what he needs to. I don't know that it's what he needs to win, but it's definitely what he needs to motivate. And especially when the odds are really against you, you know, you need that. That's what inspires people. You know, that kind of confidence will inspire people to battle and to fight for you and to give everything and to sacrifice everything and to risk everything. And he knows it. And you know, I think he can't go back now. You know, he is the character that he is, and he can't turn around and you know, become timid or show fear. And he has to be bombastic, and he has to, you know, speak like he's from the, you know, 1400s. He's got to do all these things in order to keep them motivated, and it works, and he knows it, and Carol knows it, and he knows Carol knows it. But you know, that's what's gotten him to where he is, and what will hopefully, you know, at a minimum, keep his people, you know, fighting till the end.
Listen, a lot more has been done. A whole lot more has been done with a lot less. I mean, supreme confidence, great speaking voice, beautiful teeth, and a pet tagger. I mean, you've got all the makings for a fantastic leader and a very complex, very interesting. I mean, what more can you say about Ezekiel than he, you know, he gets the job done. People follow him into battle. You know, him and Rick, I mean, we've seen a lot of groups that didn't have that type of X factor, you know, that you think the people from Terminus and how quickly they got wiped out. How different would it have gone for them if they had Ezekiel, you know, rallying the troops when that thing got infiltrated. You know, if you look at some of these other smaller groups that just got overran, Ezekiel's the X factor. He makes the difference in every situation.
Back in the office building, Daryl comes along some easy street accommodations, fully decked out with handcuffs and dog food sandwiches. Cynic, do you think the torture might have been more effective than anyone, including Daryl, might have thought?
There's some deep psychological stuff there, and forgive me if I'm wrong here, because I'm supposed to be an expert because I went and bought a microphone on Amazon, but forgive me if I'm wrong here, but I believe there was also a hand laying on the floor there. So you also had some, you know, a la Merle going on there, you know, because it was a handcuff, cuffed to the wall, and I believe there was a you know, a discarded hand laying on the ground. Yeah, I mean, we haven't seen the full, you know, inner rage of Daryl come out, but I think that might be coming. The other day, just last episode, he quoted to Carol that this is going to be fun. I think we've got some big and violent things in Daryl's future.
And it's fun to play kind of, I don't know, pop psychology, you know, with all of these characters. And it's, you know, I know I bring it up a lot, but you say that there's PTSD, but, you know, they've all got to be suffering psychologically. And, you know, I feel like the triggers, especially for someone, you know, anyone who's been through any of the trauma that they've been through, there are triggers all over the place. And I think in this situation, there are plenty of potential triggers. And, you know, it's just how do you deal with it in the you know, in the face of that? Do you cower? Or do you become Morgan and just become the Terminator? Almost literally. So, you know, I think it's always there, and I think it's one of the more interesting aspects of the show is how they deal with trauma, but also how they deal with kind of those triggers and in the face of kind of adversity, you know, what parts of them show and manifest, you know, in the face of it.
Well, let me ask you this, Ryan. Who would you be more scared of? You know, a full-on Morgan or somebody who's gone through everything that these people have gone through and had nothing wrong with them? Like, it showed no signs of any kind of mental damage or fatigue at all. Which one would you be more afraid to sit in a locked closet with?
Morgan, but I take your point. Great point, but Morgan's terrifying. Like, seeing him, it was like the best thing in this episode. I mean, Morgan and Ezekiel, easily the best things in this episode. And just seeing him go full-on Terminator mode was absolutely terrifying. Like, I felt like he could take out the Saviors by himself, you know. But if you don't show the kind of trauma that you have to have faced, you know, dealing with this world, then, yeah, there's got to be something wrong with you. But yeah, Morgan still scares the hell out of me.
I really want him to steal from Star Wars and just have like a blue glowy Cheeseman following him around, you know, just like, no, Morgan, no, you know. just sitting there with that befuddled look on his face as Morgan just slices through half the Saviors team.
What was his Aikido master's name?
What was it? Was it Eastman?
Yeah, I think so.
Was that it? Imagine him. Yeah,
he called them
in a robe. It's perfect. That's a perfect analogy. Trained him.
As Rick searches room to bedroom, he's attacked by a very angry Savior, where a close fight ends with Rick impaling the Savior on a shelf bracket. Very creative, Rick. Back at Morgan again, as he clears the building, the rest of the team captures the rest of the remaining Saviors. He comes out and sees this, confused, seeing all the captive Saviors, and he gets a flashback to Rick saying, "We can't leave them alive." That's when Morgan spots the Savior who killed Benjamin. Jesus stops Morgan from killing him, saying, "That's not what we do." Morgan asks, "Then what do we do?" Cynic, what would you do?
Well, this brings up a lot of good questions, and as I was watching this, I mean, all right, so food is running out, trying to find sources of clean water, and you have a chance to kind of eliminate this whole group of enemies. So what's more important to you? I mean, keeping these guys alive and the chance that they may end up fighting with you and helping you fight the dead, or getting rid of them and taking their supplies and using that to live on a little bit further? I mean, I wanted to see Jared die. Jared is his name, by the way, the one that killed Benjamin. I wanted to see him die more than anything in the whole episode, and I was a little let down that Morgan didn't have that one last ounce of crazy just to take him out. Because this is, we didn't yell over the wall that we're going to make friends with the Saviors. We yelled we're going to war against the Saviors, and war is dirty business, and that means there's a lot of dead bodies. In this situation, you just don't have the resources to keep these guys and hope when the war ends that they're going to be productive citizens. I personally, I feel that they should have just done away with them and moved on.
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, the rules are different when you're dealing with war. And, you know, as we talked about last week with the guy at the gas station with Carl, there's the ideal world that you want to live in, and you want to be good and you want to be merciful. And you know, in the perfect world, yeah, they'd save the Saviors, and they would be grateful. But this isn't the time for it. They're at war, and they need resources, and they need less and fewer enemies. And the alternative is, you know, they're prisoners of war. We got to feed them and be humane to them, or we just kill them. And, you know, unfortunately, in this situation, I think you got to just kill them. And I think especially if regardless, even if you say, OK, we will keep them alive, you know, that one, you know, I think Morgan deserved that kill. And I think Jesus is being a little too, you know, I think this is being set up for there being a situation where it's life or death. And Jesus has to make a decision that may, you know, ultimately really harm the group. But obviously that's where this is building to have this kind of super merciful Jesus who wants to, you know, wants everybody to live. And it's setting for a really major conflict down the road.
Hey, let me ask you this. What would you have done in that situation? If you're Jesus, do you turn a blind eye and let him take Jared out, or, you know, kill the hostages? Or do you agree that, you know, we got to keep him alive because, you know, being human and being alive is the most important resource of all?
Well, you know, my problem with this is that, one, I don't think Jesus should be leading the show there. It probably should be Morgan. He's just got more experience in the world that we've seen at this point. And that's based off of just what we've seen, right? We don't know what Jesus did before he came into the show. But these guys are not set up for prisoners in any way. They don't have places to take them, right? One thing, if you want to talk about war, one thing that most sides have when you're talking about war is something to do if you take prisoners. They have somewhere to take them, something to do with them. They don't have anybody to do anything with this, and they don't have anybody trained. And then you were speaking, Cynic, about the lack of actual resources. And when you're on a finite supply of resources such as they are, that becomes even more problematic, because to keep prisoners, you have to feed and bathe and care for prisoners. That all becomes a problem here too. So like Morgan was telling them, we're supposed to kill them. That's why we're here. Jesus, I understand, has a little bit of heart still in him, and he acts more like an actual Jesus than just Jesus trying to pick up some lettuce off the side of the road. But it seems like it's short-sighted. It seems like that there's not a real smart thought process going on with what do we do next. So I guess I would let Morgan do his thing, and the rest of the group I brought with me, they can take their shots too. Pick who you want to shoot, shoot him. You know, one bullet apiece, bing, bing, bing. I mean, take three or four people that look important so that you can question them, but the rest of them got to go.
Yeah, one or two maybe, but you're giving them way too much credit that they're going to kill somebody with one bullet. Not in this fight. Not in any time soon. I mean, they could probably walk right up to him and miss.
Well, these are the group that could shoot.
The plan is superiorly flawed because, number one, you don't have the resources to keep them. Number two, you don't have the area to keep them. Number three, you don't have the extra manpower to guard them. So what do you do with these people once you get them away from all this? You know, all you're doing is loading up a whole bunch of enemies that could rebel with it. Then, you know, you bring them to Alexandria, you lock them up, you know, in that Fancy Dan prison that Rick and Morgan built. You do that. All right, so now they're inside the walls of Alexandria and 10 or 12 of them break out. And that's eventually they get a hold of some guns and, you know, now you have a war from within. I don't like the plan. And I really think that they should have just took care of it there.
And I think Carol would agree. Quite honestly, maybe we can just bring them and they can look at some flowers and Carol can handle business because she does shoot well. As the sanctuary team closes in on their prey, Shiva comes in for an early lunch. So now back to Aaron's ambush again. They seem to be doing their job, but the team is starting to take a few hits. Aaron decides to play Grand Theft Auto and drive over a few of the breaching saviors with his car to get to Eric, who now is seen to be bleeding very heavily from the midsection. Cynic, is this our first death pool winner?
Well, listen, I called it. Eric takes an injury. He's bleeding heavily, and there's not a doctor in sight. And, you know, to go back to your earlier point about Shiva, I want to love the cat. Every time I see the cat, I mark out a little bit, and then I realize how much that must have just cost. And I just see Scott Gimple somewhere with a calculator going, all right, we can only do this three or four more times, and we're going to have to can the cat. So if we read back into the death pool, Shiva was my number two on there. So I have a feeling that I'm going to be up 2-0 on you guys before maybe the end of next episode.
Are you going to be sad about that, Ryan, if he goes up 2-0 on us, or is we playing the long game?
Playing the long game, but also I don't want Shiva to die. Shiva's awesome, you know. That would be upsetting, but I agree. I think I feel the same way when I do see every time I do see Shiva on screen. It's like yeah, that must kill the CGI must kill the budget, and hopefully if Shiva does go, it'll be like in a blaze of glory. But you know, and I still, it does take me out of it when Shiva knows who to kill and who not to kill. I mean, obviously, you know, I can understand like a relationship with Ezekiel, but it's not like everybody in the kingdom is hanging out with Shiva and petting and making sure that they're on good terms. So it's a little frustrating, you know, again, it takes me out of it a little bit that Shiva just kind of knows, who to kill and who not to kill.
Well, they made him they made the cat familiar with the armband system that they've all implemented last episode. So he knows to look at what color armband.
That's amazing training.
When that first happened, especially after the Battle of Alexandria, there was some of the best memes of King Ezekiel sitting in front of Shiva with a book with Rick and Negan and says, eat, don't eat. Some of those were hilarious. Sometimes the internet could just be gold.
Yeah, I really think that if they kill Shiv, it's going to be kind of like the old Yeller mentality where everybody's going to get really upset and cry because the animal got killed. And in this case, not even an actual animal, like a completely CGI animal played by a guy in a green bodysuit, which makes it even more hilarious. Yeah, I don't think you're going up 2-0. I think they're going to keep Shiv around. He's too much of a fan favorite.
Well, let me ask you this. Let me ask you both this. Is that the one thing that would push King Ezekiel, like, over? I mean, is that the end of this D&D master's reign? Does he drop the persona and just kind of cut his hair and maybe go make pizza for a living if the cat eats it?
I don't think so. I think he's got to know that if you bring Shiva to battle, that's a problem. Is Shiva's kind of like a specialist in that, you know, obviously it's a humongous, amazing, powerful weapon, but it's one that, you know, is a huge target, and with enough people around, you know, at the end of the day, you know, Shiva's gonna go if they're, you know, if it's in just kind of the open field. So I think he knows that, and so I think he'd recognize that if Shiva is let loose, you know, in most settings, you know, there's a good chance Shiva's gonna go just because, you know, everyone will focus the firepower. So you know, I think he's got to know. I think it would hurt him, but I don't see like a Morgan-like kind of snapping if Shiva dies.
Yeah, the shock and awe factor of Shiva from the first battle when he showed up at the end of last season, you know, that's gone, right? They know the tiger exists now. But I think, you know, it might break Ezekiel for a little bit, but I don't think it'd break him permanently. I think it'd be a small thing, and that might be a time when Carol comes back to him and she does what he's been doing to her the whole time and kind of gets him back in the right mood. That's where I think it'd go. I'm just hoping that Shiva doesn't die anytime soon.
Well, and our friend Aaron, our new friend Aaron, who says he's heard this podcast, picking up the 710 Walker's 710 Savior split for the spare. I mean, he really banked them right off the car. I mean, it was the move. It was the absolute move of the battle. And, you know, he may not have been able to save Eric, but he definitely saved the frame.
He did. Everything got saved there. He's going to roll at least a 200 this game, that's for sure.
That's right, kids. A bowling reference. Deal with it.
Woo, we're hip and savvy. The king's men gather around while Ezekiel strokes Shiva. They get radio traffic that the jig is up and the saviors are setting up the resistance. The king tells his men that the day will not end in retreat. Cynic, is this the best plan? What would you do?
Go back to the kingdom right now and reformat and come back with a better plan than, hey, they just set a trap for us, so let's spring the trap. Bad, bad, bad idea. And, you know, just from my feeling before I saw the previews for next week, it was like, ooh, you know, I've got a bad feeling about this. You know, a little bit of Star Wars callback there. I've got a bad feeling about this. And then I saw the previews for next week and it's like, things just aren't going to go well in Kingdom Land.
Yeah, I think that, you know, he's in a tough spot here because now he's projected all this confidence. He said, you know, onward, moving forward. And this is a situation where really he needs to rethink that. But he's put himself in a position where he almost can't say, you know, he can't retreat. If he does, then again, they know something's really wrong. You know, it's, yeah, I think this might be a situation where his confidence may be getting a little bit the better of him. But this is also a problem of their plan. There's no communication between the heads. So, you know, he doesn't know what's going on anywhere. Rick doesn't know what's going on there. You know, so it's just a giant kind of, everybody just has to hope that everybody else, you know, completes their mission. And all it takes is one to screw up. And so I think it becomes problematic, but you know, I think they're stuck in a position where they just has to move forward. You know, you're kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't. If they go back to the kingdom, well, there's going to be an army, you know, heading over there anyway. So you might as well try to, you know, do salvage what you can of the mission. So I don't blame him for it, but you know, you're kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Rick finds keys and goes into what he thinks is the gun room to find a nursery with a baby named Gracie. Cynic, what's going on with Rick at this very moment?
That's a rough one because, I mean, once he sees the nursery wall and the baby inside the crib, I mean, it by all appearances looks like that he just killed that child's father. And now he's got to take responsibility for it, you know, just like he did Shane's baby. You know, he's going to have to raise another kid. I mean, you could tell, you could see the look in his face like, you know, at any point, this could be me. At any point, this could be someone standing over Judith's crib, which as soon as that guy picks Judith up, he'll be promptly killed because Judith is the angel of death. I mean, look at Tyrese, look at Olivia, I mean, look at Beth. Anybody that touches that kid, you know, is looking for work somewhere else and SAG. I feel bad for Rick in that moment. I mean, but this is the reality of war. You know, anybody that gets in your way, you're going to have to deal with them. And that's why I think Jesus' thinking is so flawed. Rick reacted. It wasn't, you know, should I or shouldn't I? It was kill or be killed. And in most situations, you don't get that choice.
Yeah, it was an effective scene. And I think Andrew Lincoln did an amazing job just with how he reacted, you know, to seeing the baby. And you could just see it in him, the kind of emotional, you could see the emotions kind of come out of him and that, you know, kind of that he's a father and that he just killed, you know, he killed this baby's father and that, you know, and also like the dilemma internally, like, what does he do? I don't think he's set on taking the kid. You know, does he kill the kid? Does he take the kid? Does he just leave the kid there? You know, I don't know that he's set on it. I don't know that he knows what he wants to do. And I think it was a great job of him kind of acting out the kind of mental acrobatics that he's going through and the trauma, again, kind of resurfacing. So I thought that was a really powerful scene, and I, you know, would have been interested to see like what decision he makes with the child or with the baby.
So Rick continues his search for the lost guns when we get a special guest star and reappearance of Morales from season one. He's called the Saviors back, and now it seems like some of our favorites have been painted into a corner. Ryan, give us your final thoughts and your rating of the episode.
All right, so my final thoughts, I guess going into this season, I think that I had one kind of major reservation or fear for this season. You know, it's like we know the theme. You know, we know what's going on this season. The setting, it's a war. It's all out war, and it's, you know, Rick, it's Alexandria, it's Hilltop, the Kingdom versus the Saviors, and so, you know, we know that it's likely to be back and forth. You know, this is going to last at least the half season and probably the whole season, and it's going to be back and forth. And so I think the challenge storytelling-wise is, how do you tell a story that's engaging and kind of keeps us invested, you know, when we know where this is going? We know that Rick will win some, he'll lose some, it'll be back and forth, and eventually, you know, there'll be a major battle that somebody wins or loses, and there'll be deaths along the way. So my fear was that this knowing this, or kind of with this in mind, that the show would feel like it was dragging, and that we get a lot of kind of filler episodes. And unfortunately, overall, like, this episode did feel like filler. You know, I thought the Rick and the baby moment was really powerful, and I thought, you know, Morgan's video game moment was awesome, and I love Ezekiel, and, you know, again, any of his dialogue is great. But beyond that, like, I would challenge anybody to tell me what about this episode couldn't have been told, what about this story couldn't have been told in a 2-minute montage. And, you know, to me, that was it. Like, we got a 2-3 minute montage, you know, in an entire hour. So it just felt to me like filler. And it wasn't bad. You know, like, it was a good episode. It was tension. There were some great moments. But it just felt unnecessary. Like, we didn't need to see all of this. And so I'm a little concerned that the rest of the season kind of goes along this, where it just feels like we're just kind of biding our time until we get to that ultimate, you know, battle between Rick and Negan. Speaking of which, the one thing I really, really wanted to know, which is what happened with Negan and Gabriel, and we got none of it, which kind of bothered me too. But anyway, my overall rating, you know, it wasn't a bad episode, but like I said, I think it felt like filler. So I'm going to give it a 7, just because, like, you know, I want more. I expect more out of this show. And so hopefully we get that next week. But yeah, I'm going with the 7.
Listen, I can't be too hard on this. Most of it is because I'm on a Walking Dead high. I've just got to meet a lot of the cast at Walker Stalker. They were all fantastic to me. So, you know, my natural inclination is to support the team. It was action from nonstop. I mean, Rick fighting the father of Gracie up on the, you know, up on the top floor, great. Ezekiel stood out. Morgan stood out. Jesus was a little bit of a disappointment, only because, you know, that road less traveled thing doesn't work in the middle of a war. It's sort of like we're fighting war now. Anyway, it's interesting that you put a guy who's basically a pacifist and wouldn't hurt a fly in a key position in the middle of combat. I hated the Morales part, and I'm going to tell you why. It makes no sense. I mean, if you wanted to close that, they could have done it in a million other ways. Him showing back up as a savior, especially when we last saw him, he was headed in the absolute opposite direction. Because we all know Alexandria, Virginia, and Birmingham, Alabama, are, you know, they're pretty much neighbors. You can see them. You look out your window and they can see each other, right? No, you can't. So we shoehorned this guy in for whatever reason. And I don't understand the fans' reaction. Okay, so he was in the first episode, but that was basically it. He was in like the first episode and a half, and we never saw him again. And he never really, other than calling Rick helicopter boy, he never really had an impact on the story. I liked the episode. I'm going to go ahead and give it an 8, although I think that the battle could have been constructed and carried out a lot differently than it was.
You guys are both really nice. Now, I'm on a high from The Walking Dead 2, and there are some individual performances in this episode that I really enjoy. Jerry can do almost no wrong with me. I mean, he's awesome. I really love Jerry. King Ezekiel's pretty much in the same boat. And I really like some of the things that are happening, but the problem is there was a lot of explosions and shooting and people dying and everything, but nothing happened. Nothing. It was, A lot of jumping around. We didn't get more than 3 or 4 minutes in any single spot. It just seemed like they made no ground. So filler episode completely. And it just didn't tell any engaging stories for the most part. I had a lot of problems with the episode. Now, visually, there was some beautiful stuff. I liked how it looked. And like I said, some of the acting in it was top-notch. But the writing just wasn't there this week. It just they just needed to fill 43 and a half minutes or whatever it actually takes a runtime for a show. And they did just that, is they gave us about 4 minutes of actual good stuff and 40 minutes of junk. I give it a 5, even though, please don't take this wrong, Walking Dead fans. I love the show. I was just at Walker Stalker with Cynic, and I loved every minute of that. But this just did not meet expectations. It was nowhere near last week's episode or just about anything from the previous seasons. This was probably one of the worst episodes I've seen here in a long time. Personal opinion, but that's where we're at. So there you go from the Walking Dead Underground. We'll be kind and we'll give this a 6.5. And that's it for our review of Season 8, Episode 2, The Damned. We had a great time bringing you all the information about Walker Stalker and The Walking Dead this week from The Walking Dead Underground and Cynic Radio Podcast. We want to thank you for listening. Keep coming back every week. We have new things every week. Really new, exciting stuff coming very, very soon. Please share this with all your friends and loved ones. Send us all your comments, questions, concerns, and your best cobbler recipes to cynicradio@gmail.com. Find us on Facebook at either facebook.com/cynicradio or search for The Walking Dead Underground. It's a big group on Facebook, and you can join and be part of the 20,000 plus that are talking about The Walking Dead every week. You can also find us on Twitter at Cynic Radio and on Instagram at Cynic Radio. Also, our website, cynicradio.com. And until next time, don't get captured.
Follow the podcast on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and at thewalkingdeadunderground.com. Join us in our fight against the saviors.